We're happy to make podcasts available for selected EdWebinars for your listening pleasure. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.
Hello and welcome to today's MTSS Classroom, meeting the instructional needs of all students. Thank you for joining us today. I'm Dr. Suzanne Jimenez. I'm a National Director of Innovation and Insights for HMH and a former district leader from Virginia outside the Washington, D.C. area. I'm joined by my colleague, Tabitha Reaver, who is a Director of Intervention and Services for HMH. And we are also have a panel of national education experts with us today who you're going to meet and have the opportunity to chat with. Tabitha and I were talking before the webinar and reflecting on how when we talk to district leaders across the country, we oftentimes hear over and over the same types of questions. And I know when I was a district leader, I know some of the challenges that I was facing in my district were very similar to ones that I was hearing about in other places. So today, we brought everyone together to talk about how we can use high-quality resources, evidence-based resources and strategies to meet the needs of all students, including those students who need tiered support and what that looks like in the classroom. Before we jump right in, I do want to encourage you to join the chat and interact with us. You also have a React button. We'd really love to hear from you, your questions, your input, your feedback. And I do want to let you know you're going to receive some incredible resources. Each of our panelists has curated something special for you. And when you receive the follow-up email from HMH, you'll have those downloadable resources available, as well as contact information if you need any further information or you'd like to hear more. So, as I said, we have a wonderful panel here. I'm going to do some brief introductions, and then you'll have an opportunity to hear from all of them when we have our panel discussion. First, we have John Eisenberg. John is the Executive Director of the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. And you'll hear and learn from John's experience in the field, including his time as a state director in Virginia. We also have Phyllis Wolfram. Phyllis is the executive director of the Council of Administrators of Special Education, or CASE. And Phyllis has served in state and national capacity supporting CASE for more than 20 years, in addition to many years as a special education director. Also with us is Julie Weatherly. Julie is an attorney and consultant. And she has provided guidance and representation across the United States on legal issues related to special education and students with disabilities. She is a highly regarded expert and national speaker, and she will provide some context for us today related to special education and students with disabilities. And we have with us Tracy Hogan and Scott Reimer from Greenville County Schools in South Carolina. They're both assistant superintendents, Tracy for special education and Scott for school leadership at the high school level. Both have presented their shared work in South Carolina at national conferences, and I can tell you it is instructive and inspiring, and you will want to hear more. So it's really a treat to have them join us to talk about what's happening right in their district in the field as well. So thank you all panelists for being with us. Well, let's just jump right in. One of the things we know about our classrooms today is that things have really changed since the past, even over the last, say, 5 years. We know that we still have students who are on grade level and above grade level, and they need strong resources to continue to grow and stretch. We also have students who have a lot of the same knowledge and skills as their grade level peers, that they need some more scaffolding and differentiation, some supplemental resources in order to continue to grow toward grade level. And now more than ever, we know that we have students with significant learning gaps and differences in learning styles. These students may have foundational skill gaps. And in addition to good core tier one instruction and supplemental resources, they need intervention in order to address the significant learning gaps that they have. So this leaves our teacher, who needs to be prepared to teach a wide variety of students, a very diverse group of learners. And she or he will need strategies as well as tools and resources that will go beyond the core curriculum in order to support her teaching for students. Both of these systems need to work together in order to implement sort of that whole child model and to really support strong student outcomes. And today we're going to focus on the academic part of our MTSS. So beginning back around the 1990s is when we started using this tiered approach. A special education professor named Dr. Hill Walker at the University of Oregon was consulting with a local school district and developed this model so that leaders and teachers could use sort of a triage framework, thinking about the scale of student need within schools and classrooms. And we know that all students receive instruction in Tier 1 and the core curriculum. And then using this framework, we can think about the different supports that students need depending on their level of need. And so what we've done at HMH is sort of transition from the pyramid or the framework to a distribution curve model so that we have a more nuanced way of looking at student need. We know that we have students with a wide variety of needs. And when we're able to more precisely pinpoint where students need particular types of supports, we're better able to think about how to accelerate their learning, the critical component when we think about students who have these significant skill gaps. Using this model, we can have a more precise way of looking at where students are. Think about your district or your school or your classroom and the wide variety of needs. And this represents most classrooms across the country today, where you have students who represent every level of need. And so we have to think about how we can address the needs of all students using our strategies and evidence-based resources, the skills and preparedness that we need to build up for our teachers so that we can address student learning across all tiers or all areas of learning for students. We think particularly in this representation, we know we have students with lots of different kinds of learning needs. And if we think for a moment about students with disabilities, we know we're still striving toward the goal of having all students with disabilities spend at least 80% of their day in general education. And this creates great opportunities for collaboration between general education and special education teams. And it also requires that all teams are prepared and skilled and have the resources to address all learners in our classrooms. We also think about our multilingual learners who have added to this rich diversity of learning profile in a school. And this average of 10% include states like Texas, where the identified students are at or above 20% of the student population, and includes states like West Virginia, where it's less than 1% of the population. So in the same way that this diversity varies across the country, you probably see that phenomenon in your district or your schools. So when we think about all of the different learners that we have and the skills and the resources that teachers need, this is where our panel comes in. And thank goodness we have this great set of experts who will sort of lead us through this discussion. And again, I encourage you to check questions or input as we go along the way. But for starters, I'm going to turn it over to John. Remember, he's the executive director for the National Association of State Directors of Special Education. So he works across the country and will share with us a little bit of a national perspective of what he's seeing and hearing across the country to help sort of get us started and set the context. So, John, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Thank you, Suzanne, and what an honor to be with such incredible professionals on this presentation. I thought I'd do something a little different today, and it might not be the most popular thing, but I wanted to share with you kind of the national context before you even get into the nitty-gritties of how to do MTSS and the success that it's had. There's about five major things facing the education community, more especially special ed, that is absolutely critical to be taken into context of all this stuff. And I thought I'd just share some of that information because it really does apply to whether or not we're going to be able to succeed with some of the outcomes related to doing the MTSS process. And then before I jump into that, I just wanted to say, in my 30 years, I just, my 30 years in special ed, and I have seen MTSS just grow exponentially. And it has been the foundation for a lot of the progress we've made over the last, say, 20 years. And I'm now hearing state superintendents, I'm hearing local superintendents, local administrators, regular ed folks know what this is now. I think it's permeated our school culture. But now we've got some additional strategies outside of just making people aware of that. Well, there's five big areas that I think you guys need to be aware of that are affecting everything in special ed, but education in general. And the top five are, one is the shortages that we're facing, both in special education, both in elementary education, and then probably some of the worst shortages are in our related services area. So, and you know that all three and almost all those groups are absolutely essential in order to make the MTSS process to move forward. Let me just share with you some statistics. 44% of public schools are reporting full or part-time teacher vacancies. 48 out of 50 states report a severe shortage of special ed teachers. And then we're also looking at about a gap of about 37,000 new teachers we're going to need to be able to handle the influx of new students with disabilities between 2020 and 2030. So that is a huge issue. And what we're also seeing is that the people who are actively being recruited in those positions now don't always have the same level of expertise or training that many of us have had. So during this MTSS process, people who have been steeped and trained in special education, this might not be, this could be one of the major issues that might be affecting the efficacy of MTSS. So shortages, absolutely essential to be thinking about. Not only is that at the teacher level, but we're seeing it at the administrator level, the superintendent level. And then now, really for the first time in probably 15 years, we're seeing at the state director level, at the State Department of Education. So 63% of my entire membership, and these are folks who run your State Department of Education, who are in charge of special ed in your state, 63% of them, so out of 50 people, almost 60 state directors, 63% of them have less than 4 years on the job. So we're seeing a huge influx of people who are new, and people who are veterans have either left the profession or gone on to do something else. So absolutely critical to be aware of that. The other major issue that we're seeing is the major fallout from the pandemic. We're still feeling the after effects of that. We're seeing the gaps increase. We've seen the gaps on the latest NAEP score go as high as almost 38 points between students with disabilities and their non-disabled peers in mathematics and in reading. We just saw the latest data that came out to the report to Congress about the numbers of kids who were proficient on state assessments in 2021 in both reading and math, and it was not good. I will share with you that by the time kids got to high school, students with disabilities, only 6.8% of them passed the statewide assessment, even though that 80% or more of our students are spending their time in the regular class. And a vast majority of those students are kids who should be on grade level or just right below grade level. And then in math and reading, we saw in high school, the scores go down to 11%. So we're seeing major gaps increase because of the lost learning that we seem to have, the impact of the the impact of the forced being at home and not having communication, not having peers, the socialization. We're seeing the rise in mental health supports that kids need. So we're still really feeling the after effects of the pandemic. And it doesn't seem to be changing all that much. We've also seen the growth of politics in public education at a level that we've never seen before. And then the newest, latest thing that has been problematic is chronic absenteeism. The levels of chronic absenteeism is off the charts right now. It is one of the major guiding forces that state departments are looking at. Because you can talk about doing all the best MTSS in the world, if there's kids not showing up to school, we've got a real problem. So a lot of folks are facing that. Another big shift that has happened is that the population has shifted over the last 15, 20 years. especially since the pandemic. We've also seen a major decrease in the enrollment in public education. But the weird thing is, at the same time, even though we're seeing a dip in the overall enrollment, we're seeing an increase in special education. So our child count has gone up, and we also think we're identifying kids at a higher and better rate. But then we've got this whole confusion during that whole process. Is it the result of the pandemic? Is it a result of not having access to face-to-face instruction? All those questions are still looming, and then how we're going to catch kids up. Fourth major thing, and then there's been a major shift in the focus of the U.S. Department of Education. For many, many, many years during my tenure at the Virginia Department of Education and working in the field, we very much focused on trying to increase outcomes for kids, improve graduation rates, improve test scores, improve access to the gen ed curriculum, get them with their non-disabled peers, get them graduation results that are typical. But unfortunately, what we've seen is a shift back to an old compliance model where on any given day, you have to be responsible for over 875 requirements of IDEA. And on any given day, it's a challenge. But you add all those other three or four things that I just talked about in place, it becomes very, very difficult to be in full compliance. And we did full compliance for 30, 40 years. It really didn't move the needle on outcomes. So unfortunately, a lot of time and effort at our state departments are going to be focused on making sure that everybody's in full compliance. And that seems to be the major shift that the U.S. Department of Education is looking at. And then just the last one that I thought is important for you to understand is that a lot of time and effort right now is being spent on an increased number of complaints and due process cases. We've seen those numbers rise exponentially over the last 3 years, and we're now seeing some states with an increase of over 200% of complaints and due process cases happening. And then between that and monitoring, it's eating up a lot of people's time. So unfortunately, there's some outside effects that are happening on our education system that we need to take in context, knowing how well the MTSS process works and how positive it's been on outcomes. But I think you've got to understand those couple contexts before jumping right into that conversation, just because it is what's happening. It's real, and it's in the face of everybody that are boots on the ground. So I just wanted to share that little piece. I know that you're going to hear some amazing stuff from other presenters. So I'm going to shut up and turn it over back to you, Suzanne.
No, thank you. I think, you know, we need to understand the authentic context of some of the things that are happening. But I'll tell you, I'm really encouraged when I think about some of the things that I've seen responding to some of those challenges, right? When I think about the work that you're going to hear about that Tracy and Scott are doing in Greenville, or some of the things that Tabitha and I hear about as we go around the country. I was just at the National Case Conference in the past couple of years, huge attendance by people who are just hungry to collaborate and to work together, to find ways of addressing the building teacher capacity and the shortages. So I think for every reality we struggle with, we know about the legions of people who are working together to make a difference and to say, well, this is where we are. So how can we grow and what can we do? And fortunately, we've got organizations like CASE that really provide that frontline support. Julie knows from sort of what she hears about some of those challenges, it sort of helps reframe it. So Phyllis, I wonder you lead one of the most prominent national organizations for education, period. And I think it's important to say education. I know it's focused on special education administrators, but we know, as John said, we're talking about 80% of the time in gen ed now. So we're talking about people collaborating and working together. Sometimes there seems to be some confusion about how to get that done, right? Or how do we work together, and how do we think about providing that education together? I know you've done a lot around building capacity, but what are the kinds of things that you're hearing about that are happening and how districts and schools are addressing them for instruction?
Yeah, I think that, you know, John hit some real important points, but I think when we really look at MTSS and the framework that presents for us, and we have to remember it's not a program, it's a framework, and all teachers in every school fit into that framework. And I think one of the things that we've learned is special educators have a lot to bring to the table for MTSS and should not be this separate program over just doing things for students with disabilities. But we have to take those skills and we have to utilize, even though we have a shortage, we still have occupational therapists and physical therapists and speech language pathologists in that in our settings that we need to be using in that MTSS structure to make a significant difference. And those professionals, those individuals in those schools, they want to help all students. And when we think about, as John talked about, that increase in students with disabilities and that identification and that referral rate that's going up in all those schools, if we had all hands on deck in an MTSS structure, we would be preventing some of those referrals to special education. So the early intervention for all hands on deck, for all special educators, related service personnel, which we refer to as specialized instructional support personnel as well, we need those individuals working in that MTSS structure. That's what makes the difference. That's what makes a huge difference when we're collaborating with our general ed partners.
Right. And when I think about like the referral rate that you and John mentioned, I think you're absolutely spot on thinking about what are the strategies and the resources that we can use to address student needs. Sometimes I'll hear from district leaders of all types that they're just not sure what else to do. And they're unsure about that line of where they're providing intervention. And somehow that's become a question. And Julie, you and I have talked about this early on, because I'll hear if we can't use this resource or strategy in gen ed, because that's in special ed. Or in special education, they'll say, well, they use that in gen ed, so it's not special enough. And so thinking about really how we're using resources, not where. And so Julie, you want to weigh, I know you've given some guidance on this. Enlighten us a little, if you would, in your perspective.
Well, I join with Phyllis and John in thanking you for the opportunity to be with this expert panel. I always learn a lot when I'm with other people, not just about the law, but what's going on out there. And John, thank you for all of that uplifting information. I was glad to have someone else delivering it, because usually the lawyer delivers all the bad news. So thank you. Bottom line is to the question of hearing people say things like, oh, we can't use that particular curriculum, methodology, whatever it might be, resource, because that's something that regular ed uses. So special ed means it has to be different. Is clearly wrong. You know, when people use words like we can only do this, we can only do that, my eyebrows are going to go up, because that's going to take the I out of IEP and the I out of IDEA, the individual nature of everything we do in special education. Turning to the law itself and further answering that situation and that question, turning to the actual law itself, which I find my obligation to always do. Sometimes I actually forget, believe it or not, after 39 years of working in this area, what the law actually says, because people make things up as they go along. But bottom line is, special education is defined as specially designed instruction that is designed specially to meet the unique needs of a child with a disability. But more important is the definition of specially designed instruction. And it talks about and uses the word specifically adapting as appropriate to the needs of a particular student, either the content, methodology, or the delivery of the instruction. And there's nothing in the law that says that means it has to be something that is entirely different. In fact, it really encourages us to use the same, but to make it unique based on the needs of the particular student. And that might be adapting in intensity, duration, frequency, that kind of thing. So, you know, in summary, the law doesn't say anything like that. And I always think that people who use those kinds of, oh, we can't do that, we can't do this, because usually fill in the blank, whatever that reason is typically something that's not individualized.
Thank you. I think there's a little bit of a nuance. I saw a question in the chat about the funding too. And that's something Phyllis and I had talked about offline. And I think as former directors, we think about how we work with our colleagues in district leadership to think about how we provide the resources. It's not easy. I don't mean it as a pat answer, but I think it's possible. Phyllis, I think you'd agree based on the conversation that we had.
I would. And I think, you know, as educators, first and foremost, we are part of a school community. I know this conversation or this issue would come up a lot with regard to our paraprofessionals. You know, when we had paraprofessionals, everybody wanted to use them for lunchroom duty. And we said, well, you know, we're using them, we're paying for them with special ed funds, whether that's state or federal funds, so you can't do that. But we said, you can do it if everybody else has a turn, right? So if it's a school requirement and everybody has that job and everybody's sharing it, then it's A-okay. If everybody's doing NTSS, it's part of a school requirement. Everybody has to do bus duty. Everybody has to do lunch duty. Everybody's got to do interventions with all kids. We are a school community, and that's how we function. And if we're not, and that's not happening in your state, I would really challenge you to have that conversation with your state leaders and say, this is how we need to function to be successful as a school community.
So when we think about these models, thank you for that. I think, oh, what would be an exemplar? Who could we hear from that's been doing this, who could really share how it's done? And that is why we have Tracy and Scott here today. You've done so much in your school district on collaboration, on instruction, on all of this. And so I'd love for you to just share some of the perspectives on what you've heard and some of the strategies that you think are helpful here.
Sure. And again, I want to echo, thank you so much. It's quite an honor to be here. Scott and I were like, are you sure they want us? But we do appreciate the opportunity. I wrote down the things that John was going over when the first thing he talked about, the shortages, the test scores, all of those things. I think Mr. Reimer and I came together several years ago to kind of say, how are we going to attack this problem? And I think he's okay with me saying he didn't know the majority of his kids with disabilities were sitting in gen ed classrooms. I led a special ed department. We were supposed to take care of special education, right? And I think that's how, in my experience, everyone has kind of functioned. And so, you know, we were working as special ed departments to get better at serving our students. We were not focusing as much on general education unless we were talking about inclusion and co-teaching. Those, of course, were things that we were good at, but we had not moved at, you know, getting our strategies that would benefit students with disabilities in the hands of general education teachers and in the hands of general education leaders. So we really had lots of collaboration and time that he and I worked together when he was at a school level. And then when he came to the central office, we really created a plan to try to infuse special education in pretty much every conversation with high school leaders so that it became a natural piece and part for that to happen. But we had to spend a lot of time educating folks here at the central office and our leaders out in the schools just about why we needed to all come together. We spoke about it today in that framework of MTSS, and it absolutely is that. But I think that there's even just this bigger global understanding that special education, we can say it's not a place, we can say it's not a location, we can say it's a service, but until we make people come to a meeting to talk about their own data and they're the gen ed folks doing it, I don't know if they know what we mean. So we've really partnered really to look at all the ways and avenues that we can get kind of special education infused at the core of all of the gen ed meetings. Scott, I don't know if you want to speak more specifically about that on your end or your experience.
Yeah, thanks, Tracy. I think you kind of set that up well in terms of I was a pretty good teacher, I thought. I was a good assistant principal. I was a good principal at two different levels, and I'd like to think I'm good in the current job that I'm doing, but I'm not an expert in special education. I took the classes that were part of my degree. And just like finance or just like human resources, it wasn't an area of focus. And so I was very much a leader, whether it was in the classroom or as a principal, I was very much a leader in asking others to help with students that struggled in school, whether that's students with disabilities or students who aren't officially identified as a student with disability, but struggle in school and maybe would be identified had they gone through that process. So, John mentioned the shortage in teaching at special education, but even at fully staffed, and I think I probably speak for schools across the country, even fully staffed, you're not going to make gains in students with disabilities or any student who struggles without with just those that are specialized in that field. The special education teachers at best are a very small percentage of what is in a staff. So to truly make change, you've got to empower and educate and inform and give the tools to the general educators where these students are sitting for most of the day to own and take ownership of the learning of those students and not suggest that that is the job or the responsibility or the or whatever a phrase you would coin that of the special educators. And even in an inclusion class, we had that mindset that, well, the special education teacher would work with the students with disabilities and the gen ed teacher would work with the gen ed. Well, that's not the way it should work, but that was the mentality. Now, in fairness to our general education people like myself, when you don't have some of the skill sets and you don't have some of the initiatives and some of the tools in your toolbox, if you will, to know how to reach those students, even if you felt that ownership, you must have some tools for that. And I think one of the things that Tracy and I did was, first of all, try to infuse amongst principles that all students matter. All students can be successful. And that sounds very easy to say, and you would think very easy for people to buy into, but it's not. I supervise 15 high schools, and that's very much a challenge at some of those schools. But once we got there, then it was like, okay, we agree with you. We're all in. We're tired of you talking about that. We know all students matter, and these students are sitting in gen ed classes. But what do we do? We don't know what to do. And so I think that's where you have to come in with those supports, whether that's educating them, providing programs, and I hate using the word program, but solutions such as UDL, the strategies that work, train the general education teachers on those things. And they're now going to take those strategies and implement them, which will, in theory, help the students with disabilities. But beyond that, it would help every student. There's nothing that these strategies would do that would help students with disabilities that wouldn't help any student in the class, regardless of where they may be performing in that class.
Mm-hmm. That's so much of it, isn't it? If you have a strong intervention system and process, you're really addressing the needs of so many learners. And then your teachers have something that they can do other than refer students, because sometimes that comes out of just, I don't know what else to do. And I think that you've really worked so hard. I remember hearing a presentation that Tracy and Scott gave. I've seen them a couple times now. And one of the quotes that I took away was, you don't have to be the expert, but you have to use the expert. I don't know which one of you might remember saying that, but I think that goes to what you're speaking about. And how did you build some of that in your teachers? Sort of from the model, Tracy.
Yeah, well, Scott said it before he takes credit for it. He's the one that said it. I'm the one that said, if you want to move your school, you got to move your kids with disabilities. So, you know, there's that one. But I would say that us modeling, I think he stands in front of folks and says, I didn't know, but now that I know better, I've got to do better. And I know he would probably say that, but I do think it's important that we can stand up and say, we don't have all the answers, but we're willing to try these things. And these are the things that we do know work. And it's okay if for 20 years you've been doing something different. It's what we're going to do today and move forward. And I think that, you know, he gains a lot of respect from the people by him just being willing to admit and own that. Scott, do you see that differently?
Absolutely. I think one of the most powerful things any leader can do is, be honest about their own deficiencies or areas for which they were not experts. And again, as a not only as a teacher, but even as a principal, I can cringe at some of the things that I believed and said to our staff in terms of students with disabilities and providing those supports. It was almost as if it were okay for there to be two classes of students, if you will, that functioned inside of a school. And that was okay. That's all I knew at the time. And I think there's still principals, there's still teachers who believe those things, because that's when they went to school, that's the way those things were done. And so when the leader can stand in front of them and said, I used to think this way, I now know better. And not only do I know better, I've learned these strategies and that these particular things help students. And again, it's very, if you're in education for the right reasons, when you use the term all students, I think that resonates with everyone, because I think every person who's in education for the right reasons want all of their students to succeed. And so I think we spend so much time breaking students into categories and subgroups and all the accountability models that exist out there. But if you're focused on all students, then all of those subgroups will also rise. And Tracy mentioned that you can't move a school without moving students with disabilities, but that's also students in high poverty, your ML students. All of those subgroups are going to move your school if you provide those supports for them.
And I think what's important is that you've talked about sharing this with teachers and setting the example and modeling it, but you have really taken actions to equip your teachers. You're not just telling them get out there and do it, but you have professional learning, you have structured intervention programs, you make it a priority in scheduling. And so it seems that some of those are those and more strategies that you're doing more than just talking about it. You're actually putting actions in place.
Yeah, I definitely think it's a long-term process because we are a large district. So we have, over 90 locations. So we had to start with first what our tools were. Certainly messaging was a big piece of this. And I keep going back to what John said about compliance and how the federal government may be moving towards that. I think a big piece that we have to make sure special educators understand is that we know from 1975 to whatever year Arnie Duncan said results-driven accountability, that that was the important thing, was compliance. And it's still important. But now we need kids to learn to read and we need to monitor that. So we kind of have to, I think, give people a pass for that piece, like, because people don't want to change. They're like, that's all I know. That's what I was supposed to do. I met my timelines, all that kind of stuff. So I think we do have to educate teachers, especially those who have been around, to say, hey, we're not criticizing what you've been doing. The rules have changed and they're changed to protect the students in a better way. And we're going to help with that. So yeah, certainly we are working on educating, teachers, but I do think our big push has been with UDL. But we also have had to do a lot of retraining for administrators to support that, because I think all of us have seen times where we've done training on, say, co-teaching or something out in the schools, and nothing can be sustained if our leaders don't know how to monitor and support it. So we're kind of hitting it from all angles and all sides. We have some documents that we use at schools, but we put a lot of ownership, our hashtag is shared ownership, but we put a lot of ownership on the leaders at the schools for all of their students. They certainly work with the special education department, but I would venture to guess at least at most of our principals, definitely at the high school level, when I'm working with Scott, can give you, how many and what percentage of students are disabled in their building. But that's not a big win for me. It's a big win for me when they can tell you how they're disabled, where they're sitting, who's teaching them, and what's happening. And it's a bigger win when I don't have to say anything. And Scott or the gen ed people are leading the meetings, and I can just either, not be there even sometimes. So I do think one of our strategies is educating special ed that sometimes you have to back up a little bit, because you're going to have to release some of the control of that compliance piece to get our others on board to do it. If we make it so hard, they're not going to be willing to, because they're going to be fearful. And so I think demystifying things and really helping and seeing that we can give away a little bit of control for the good.
Yeah, Tracy, I'd like to just piggyback on your compliance comment. you know, a comment from Nike, instead of just do it, you just know it. You know, it's the rules. You just know the rules. Just follow the rules. You know, we expect kids to do it all day, every day. And, you know, that process was put in place for a reason. And all those rules and all that is really culminated into a process to reach outcomes for kids. So I think we have to move beyond really focusing on compliance, but know that it has its place and know that our number one goal from compliance is an outcome for students and students with disabilities. So I think leadership is key there. I think, you know, you have to kind of compartmentalize and put that in its place and know that, you know, one year, a number of our states, we got together and we counted the number of compliance standards per state. California won. California had like 1,500 dot your I's and cross your T's. There's no way you can know all those. Just know, do the best you can. And when we make mistakes, we're going to correct them. And that's the best thing that we can do. So I think so many times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think, and Julie, you've probably seen this, really when schools and leaders work toward what's best for students, really keeping the idea of what makes sense, what would drive the best outcomes, what supports the teachers, what helps student outcomes, then it makes sense. And you're not in fear, as you said, of the compliance because you know you're doing the right thing. When you're always doing the right thing, it tends to be that you're within those rules. Julie, do you think that's fairly true from what you see?
Oh, more than fairly true. I have been around for, close to 40 years doing this work. And so I have seen the compliance piece, then the outcomes piece, and the compliance piece, and the outcomes piece competing over which they're going to focus on. I'm actually upset to hear, and talked to Phyllis about this, that there have been a shift back to the old, what I call the clipboard, walking around and dinging every little failure to dot an I or cross a T. Particularly in light of the fact that courts don't really look at those things. They're going to look at them, but they only look at them to the degree that they're educationally harmful to the student. What they really look at is, has the child made appropriate progress in light of the child's circumstances? They don't care necessarily. Someone forgot to send a prior written notice that they want to know. Well, how did that impact the child's progress? That's what courts look at. And so I get very frustrated. I understand it. I have lots of friends at state departments of education. So I understand that focus because it's coming from the federal perspective. It just doesn't, unfortunately, focus on what courts do, which bothers me because that's what I have to defend. Whether or not a student is actually making appropriate progress. And that's what I'm most concerned with because, yeah, we're going to argue that many of those procedural issues are no harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. Really looking at is the educational harm.
Mm-hmm. For example, if I came to Greenville, South Carolina, I would not really be thinking about procedural issues because you can see every intention, every effort, every plan, every message, it's all driving toward the spirit of providing that instruction for students. I'm sorry, John, were you going to say something?
And I think the silver lining with MTSS is the framework itself provides this incredible roadmap that has led to lots of outcomes for many, many kids. I mean, before a lot of this initiative, before the pandemic, it was really going strong. And we were seeing the most amount of change statewide by using the MTSS process and drop in whatever subject you want it to be, whether it's reducing the number of kids that get referred for blah, blah, blah. It really does have promise and it's got the research. And if you do it right and you follow the framework and everybody has the same philosophy, you can move mountains. You really can. And unfortunately, it's just now we're going to have to mix and match how much of that we do with how much of the clipboards that we do and walk around. My druthers would be to focus on what we all got in the field for, which is to make sure kids get a life like we want in terms of our adult life, to be able to live, work, and play in communities of our choice. Now, if you didn't send your prior written notice, I'm not sure that's going to affect some of those outcomes. But anyhow, a lot of people got into the field to make do what's right for kids. And I think that MTSS process itself really lends itself to that, unlike any other, a lot of the other interventions or methodologies or even frameworks I'd seen in the past 20, 30 years.
John, I'd just add, I'm sorry, Sam. I would just add to that. I think that goes back to what I said earlier, is that empowering the people who are, hold the accountability of this at the school level, you know, so typically that's the principal, and depending on the size of the school, it could be an assistant principal who oversees a particular department. We've got to provide them the skill sets to understand and to know what to look for, what to expect, what that vision is at the school. And because they're going to be inspecting it. And that's the part that we can roll out at the district level or whatever level you have at the state level, all these initiatives and all these things, and people can understand it and buy into it. But if someone's not inspecting that and providing support for the teachers who either aren't doing it the way it needs to be done, or because they're defiant about it, or in most cases, it's more they just don't know how to do it. And so Tracy can't be in 100 schools in Greenville County, I mean, which is what we have. I can't be in every day 15 high schools. So you've got to somehow build the structures. And that's what we've worked so hard with, both in the hiring and onboarding of new principals and assistant principals, but also in the professional development for them to know what to look for, to know what to expect, and when it's not there, to know how to help support those teachers.
I'm watching our time a little bit. Thank you, Scott, because I know that we've got lots of questions that have been in the chat. I did see a comment, John, to your point about the post-school life and transition. And I think I agree with you that if we don't teach students to read well and to have math skills for the career of their choice, then, as you said, something like a written note will have less of an effect. Our real goal is to provide that the education and the skills through all of our strategies and interventions. So I do want to try and catch some questions. I'll say that we'll be able to see the question record. And so you'll be receiving follow-up from us. You'll have opportunities to be in contact with us. We'll try and get all of the question answered. But I had a question earlier, because this has become such a hot topic, about artificial intelligence or AI in special education. I had shared with panel members everywhere I go, that is the hottest topic for conferences and webinars and other things. And so I thought we could just spend a few minutes on it. Phyllis, if you want to start us off, I think you had some thoughts about the role or the place or the expectation or benefit of AI in special education.
Yeah, so I'm one of those people who, you know, a little fearful, kind of hands off, because you don't know until you learn. And then when you learn, you know, your knowledge is power, and you realize it's a tool, and you have to treat it like every other tool that you have. It's not the end all be all. I most recently saw some resources, some programs that some companies are using to assist teachers in their IEP development. But they gave some great cautions too, like never ever use a student's name if you're in ChatGPT or Copilot or other places, you know, on the World Wide Web. But that it can offer as a tool a number of ideas for interventions. You can put in very specific information about a fourth grade student who is struggling with reading comprehension and a little bit more information. And for some of our newer teachers, we know that even teachers who are maybe not fully credentialed, who are coming into our school buildings, it could serve as a tool for ideas about intervention, about how to maybe look differently at your present level of performance. So I think that the key is educating our educators on how to use some of those tools. I know there are a lot of pros and cons out there. I recently spoke to a principal who was sharing that his high school English teachers were not loving it one bit, and that they had special things in place to ensure that they were receiving work that was done by the student and not by artificial intelligence. And that was, of course, a little above my head, being retired for several years out of the school. But I some of the things that I have been seeing could really be helpful to some of our teachers in special education if used appropriately. And we learn how to, again, I'll say, use it as a tool to assist us and not be the end all be all.
Thank you for that. If any other panel members want to speak to that, the use of AI in your schools, and I think we have some tools that are making it easier for teachers and in ways that can support, as you said, teachers who are newer to the profession, where we don't substitute AI for the teacher, but really right. bring it in as a support.
Suzanne, I've seen stuff that would really sift through complicated data, especially around assessment data, even using the MTSS framework. If you're collecting a lot of the data, it could do a lot of the manual work that sometimes would free up the individual from having to do the data piece and do more of the coaching on the interventions piece. Mm-hmm. And the same, I think that holds a lot of promise for the compliance part. Let's free the human being up to do what they're good at, which is teaching, and leave the computer stuff do the compliance. So I think a lot of companies I've seen and vendors are beginning to play with it. It's just going to be around the politics of all this now, because there's so much swirling about it, but fascinating what it can do.
Mm-hmm. Lots of possibilities. Tracy and Scott, what about in Greenville, where you've done so much crossover?
That may not be the area that we are experts in. I will say, having just attended a session at HMH last week, that we had lots of great conversation about, and what I believe would be excellent would be really what John said as part of really focusing, districts focusing on using it for the adults until we get a handle on this, not how much the kids can use it, but what can we do to free up for skills for things that they are specially designed that only the human can do. When there were several presentations at the end of one, I said, okay, I got to give an analogy for this because I have to see if I'm thinking about this correctly. What I said is we shouldn't be so scared of it. It's happening all the time. When we go to the doctor's office, we know the surgeon can take our temperature, he can take our blood pressure and all the things, but he doesn't. Someone else does that. So it frees up time for him to be able to do just the things with me, correct? And they were like, yes. And I'm like, so that's really what we would want to be focusing on using it for, is for adults to maybe, again, all these compliance things. Again, it speaks to that piece about shortages, but also speaks to about some of the training that we're getting. A lot of teachers that have alternative training, that we may be able to use AI for some really ways to support our educators in all of the things that we've got them to do for compliance, so that they can spend more time one-on-one with the relationships and with the students.
Mm-hmm. It goes back so much to, I've heard all of you talk about the relationships and the trust between providers, so that we're really building that. So when we're talking about leadership, when we're talking about co-teaching, interventions, MTSS, that we're really thinking about how the whole team works together. And Tracy, I love that analogy. I had not heard that about, you know, those kinds of tasks that maybe are more routine or can be handled to free up our talented educators and growing to really do those things best. Julie, do you have any cautions from your side?
One thing I was going to say is, I think I was going to follow up with what Phyllis said in terms of training people on how, but also the don'ts. I do worry. I guess I'm just a frenetic lawyer. you know, when people come up to me and say, how, you know, all our teachers are starting to use AI, and I'm like, well, have they been, you know, instructed on things not to do? The FERPA violations, for one, you know, not having data to support what something might write. I love testing AI on special ed law, and it gets it wrong every time. So as lawyers, have all been trained on how, you know, they've been sanctioned for, you know, misusing it or citing it for you know, case law that doesn't apply and so forth and so on. So we have to be careful. But I really love the notion of all of the nitpicky dotting I's and crossing T's, if that could be, if AI could alleviate some of our staff. You know, we're talking about staffing shortages. Many people leave just because of all the burdensome paperwork. It has nothing to do with the fact that they don't love teaching and they mm-hmm. don't love the relationship side of things and getting their jobs done well and so forth because of all the nitpicky procedural stuff. So I love that idea. I hadn't, you know, we're just now getting into it. I haven't, when you sent us, you know, some inquiry about AI and that was the big thing, which it is, I had just hadn't experienced any problems with it. But I always get concerned with, you know, I've struggled with computer generated IEPs.
Right.
Unfortunately, it becomes a cut and paste job and teachers, you know, I just remember the days of, you know, IEPs written out in longhand. And to me, when I looked at those, they were much more individualized because they required a lot of thought individually about each child versus, you know, just sticking information into wherever. And I'm not well versed on AI. Okay.
It has been a minute, I have to say, since I thought about those handwritten IEPs, which I generated myself many years ago.
Yeah.
There are
probably people listening to me being horrified. Oh my gosh.
Right.
It was usually in triplicate.
We did it.
Having moved to computer generated IEP and software programs and all of that kind of thing. So I'm going to have to get used to it and start really thinking through some of the concerns that AI might bring up in terms of legalities. But I think the legal propositions will remain the same. They need to be Live. They need to be database. There needs to be support behind everything that is in that IEP rather than something that's computer generated, AI generated, whatever it might be.
But we'll keep thinking about all of the possibilities, the supports for teachers and the possibilities for anything that helps us to support improved outcomes for students through interventions and innovation. And to Jeff Lavender's point from the chat about scheduling, I'm just thinking that's another way we'll prioritize individualized scheduling. Maybe that's where AI can help us. So I'm noticing we've just got 1 minute left. I'm sorry that we didn't get to answer all the questions. Please watch for your follow-up email because it will have a lot of resources, a lot of contact information. Panel, thank you so much for your expertise and your participation. Tabitha, thank you for being a great partner. I want to thank Lisa Sineski, or my other partner at HMH, who helped coordinate and put this whole webinar together. And for all of you who attended or listened to the recording, thank you so much. We were so glad to have you here with us today. Thank you so much for joining.
Goodbye. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this EdWeb podcast. If you'd like to receive a CE certificate, you must watch the video recording. Recordings and quizzes can be found in the EdWebinar archives. Please visit home.edweb.net/podcasts for more information.